From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Steve Inskeep talks about his latest book, Imperfect Union, and the historical impact of Jesse and John Fremont. Then Mario and Kathy Costantini look back at 40 years with their furniture company, La Lune, and their first customer, Ralph Lauren.
You can imagine we were 23, we were just starting out, and to have Ralph Lauren order our furniture for his home was really encouraging. We thought maybe we got something here.
And we'll hear some chamber music performed by the Prometheus Trio recorded on site at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. In 1850, a magazine declared John Fremont as one of the three most important world historical figures since Jesus Christ. Wait, who? Most of us don't recall the name Fremont from our history lessons, even though you can find a Fremont Village, a river hotel, or even a school throughout the country. But John Fremont was very much a part of westward expansion, the mapping of America, the Civil War, and even the origins of the Republican Party. John's wife, Jessie, was an equally important historical figure, the daughter of a U.S. senator who was deeply involved in the West. Jessie Fremont used her connections to make her husband's career as a wilderness explorer, writer, army officer, and California conqueror possible. Steve Inskeep dives into the lives of the Fremonts in his latest book, Imperfect Union. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share why this power couple of the 19th century should capture everyone's attention now.
Steve Inskeep, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to be on the program.
So despite some sort of street building or establishment named after the Fremonts all around the country, most of us didn't learn about them in our history courses. So what first drew you to their story?
I'm not sure that we learn a lot in any history courses. I wish Americans knew more history. I wish I knew more history, frankly. But I did read history as a kid. And I read things that, I don't know, stereotypically you'd think a little boy would read about. I mean, I read about the Old West and gunfighters and also the Civil War, and I got interested in railroads. And it's really interesting when you read about the Old West, the Fremonts appear in some of those books as these very famous and interesting characters. He's a Western explorer. You read about the Civil War and you discover them again because he was a Civil War general. And she, Jessie Fremont, had an argument with Abraham Lincoln. You read about railroads and there they are again. They're all through 19th century history. So later, as a grown-up, when I began looking at westward expansion, they seemed to me to be ideal characters to focus on. It was an opportunity to tell the story of a developing nation through the eyes of these two very interesting people.
And considering especially John Fremont's role in mapping the West, I'm quite surprised that I don't recall any lessons about them in all of our lessons about manifest destiny. You know, it's our duty, it's our obligation to go and expand West.
Yeah, I think that this is a period that we as Americans are not quite sure what we think about, because a lot of people were shoved out of the way in a very racist way for white settlement. And it was not all white settlement, by the way. There were very diverse, very different kinds of people moving West, but it was seen as this new race of people, the Americans, going west and shoving aside Indians and shoving aside Mexicans to make room for the American version of civilization. We're not sure what we think about that, and so it's a little hard to teach it precisely, even though we can be proud or can feel proud of the result, this grand and global nation that would not be what it is but for reaching from sea to sea.
Exactly. And I will come back to that point. But with Jesse's early history of mapping the West, you know, just reading some of the trials and tribulations, but also just the tools that he had to use and how smart he was with how, I can't even fathom, you know, how they did that. So I'm curious, did you get to familiarize yourself with the tools Fremont would have used during his mapping expeditions?
Yeah, I tried to. They're really basic. At one point, even I bought a sextant. You know, I ordered a sextant and tried to figure out how to use it to, you know, measure the angle of the sun. It's a remarkable challenge and one that I really didn't understand. And I'm not sure that I have much more than an amateur understanding of it now. But think about this. The problem that you face, it's the 19th century, and people all around the world were facing this problem. And the question was, how do you measure the surface of the Earth? The distance between places and the way that they look, how do you do that when you can only ever see a tiny bit of the Earth at any one time? Even on the highest place you can climb to, you only see a tiny bit of it, and it's very hard to measure. You're not going to get a satellite view in 1842. And so what they would do was navigate the same way that sailors were doing at sea, using the sun and the stars. And you would have to take rigorous and precise measurements and figure out the exact angle of the sun at an exact time of day on a particular day of the year, and using that and comparing it with other measurements that had been taken at other times and also meticulously recorded, you could figure out maybe where you were on the surface of the Earth, or you could be guided by the North Star if you took the readings at night, or various other constellations. You could do these things, and you could also use a barometer to measure altitude, because of course the air gets thinner as you go higher. And of course you have to make allowances for the weather and everything else, but you can get an idea of how high you are, provided you're able to compare your current measurement with measurements taken meticulously at sea level or someplace else. It was this constant process. And one of the things that I love about learning about John C. Fremont doing this is that he was an amateur. He was a guy who had gotten interested in celestial navigation by looking at the pictures in a book that was in Dutch, which he could not read. That was his formal education in celestial navigation. And then he became a kind of apprentice to a French immigrant named Nicolette, who mapped parts of the upper Midwest and the source of the Mississippi River and other areas. And Fremont got to go along on a couple of his expeditions. And so he learned his task, he learned his science that way. Now, there have been critics about how precise he was or how precise he wasn't, and he would even get into controversy with other cartographers. But he did one commendable thing, and that is that in making maps of the surface of the Earth, he would only put on the map things he had seen himself. He would not rely on the reports or rumors of other people, and therefore his maps would have blank spaces if he hadn't been there. They wouldn't have rivers that didn't really exist or mountains that weren't quite there or things that were on other maps at the time.
And of course, one way Americans got to learn about all of his mapping adventures was through the written accounts that his wife, Jessie Fremont, was able to help ghostwrite, publish, facilitate. And I find her to be quite an astounding person.
Yeah.
Even with the fact that she tried to follow her father and work for him simply by cutting her hair, that it would be easier to follow him as if she presented like a male. And I'm wondering what you think of their relationship in particular, because it starts, they're engaged for a short time, married for a short time, and then he's off on expeditions. And this is a ton of time. So what do you think of their relationship being truly special, especially considering a lot of their marriage was spent apart?
Yeah, it was a strange relationship, although I don't think it was totally unprecedented for the time for people to be away from home, for men to be away from home, away from their wives and families for months or years at a time, because transit was so slow and communication was so bad and certain jobs demanded this. But he was an extraordinary case even for then, because he would be gone for months or even years at a time and leaving her behind. But there was something that she, Jessie, got out of this young U.S. Army lieutenant. She was a girl. She was in a very gendered society with very strict gender roles. She did get an opportunity to be educated more as a boy was, and in fact had a boy-sounding name because Senator Thomas Hart Benton had wanted a son and wanted to name the son after his father, Jessie. Got a daughter, so he changed the name slightly, the spelling slightly, and called her Jessie. And took her around with him as he went to work at the U.S. Senate, or took her with him when he went to visit various presidents, beginning with Andrew Jackson. And she became interested in politics and wanted to do things that were supposed to be reserved for men. The expansion of the West, political life itself, ambition, running for office. She wanted to do these things. She was restricted, of course, from doing them, but was able to operate to some degree through her equally ambitious and very talented husband, who she promoted in endless ways. And when he was away for those many months or years, she would serve as his publicist and political representative in Washington, often going to visit and chat with much older senators and even presidents whom she had known since she was a girl.
Now, with your job as a radio host, of course, people will most recognize, and your career as an author, I'm curious, how does your job in radio influence your writing style for your books, or vice versa? Because with history, it's so important to set the stage in an engaging way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think that one of the most flattering things that I've heard about this book is people will say, when I read it, I hear your voice. I hope that that would be true because I'm writing the way that I talk and I'm doing that for the radio and trying also to do that in print, even though perhaps the sentences are a little longer and the story is certainly longer. But there's something that is in common between the two kinds of writing, and that is that you try both in radio and on the printed page, you try, or you, I try, let's say that, to write visually, to put pictures in people's heads, to make sure that you can see the landscape passing by, so that when John C. Fremont climbs a mountain and nearly dies on the way up the mountain and finally plants an American flag on the top of the mountain, I hope that you can see that image of him looking out over other peaks in the Rocky Mountains and deciding he must have climbed the highest point in North America, which he hadn't, but it made a great story and he was a great publicist, so he went with that. I hope that you get a chance to see that. And I hope that's also true on the radio, where we're telling stories. And we, for a long time, had that phrase, NPR takes you there, that we would have sounds that would take you to a place on the other side of the world you would never otherwise visit. And often it's actually the words that take you there. It's the stories that take you there. So I'm always trying to write in a visual way for either medium. And sometimes I'm doing both on the same day. I'm working the show in the morning and writing a book in the afternoon.
Well, you certainly take us there in a great way, and it was fantastic to explore the lives of these amazing people.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you very much.
Steve Inskeep is a journalist, a host of NPR's Morning Edition, and the author of Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. Inskeep spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski from a studio in Washington, D.C. Coming up next, we visit La Lune Collection, a furniture company located in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. On East Burleigh Street in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood, there's a set of low, cream-colored buildings with red awnings. The Florentine Opera makes its home there, but we're not visiting the opera today. Today, we're meeting the opera's landlords, Mario and Kathy Costantini. They're the owners of La Lune Collection, a rustic, eco-friendly furniture company they founded 40 years ago. Their clients include Ralph Lauren, Marriott Hotels, Radisson Hotels, Ritz-Carlton, Four Seasons, and Disney Resorts. I visited the Costantinis at their River West offices recently to learn more, and Mario began by explaining how their partnership began.
Kathy and I met in 1977 at Marquette. We were both students there. I was a pre-med student. Kathy was a French major. And I wanted to, we graduated, and I wanted to start medical school in Argentina, where I'm from, but I got drafted in the military in Argentina, so Kathy and I decided I would stay here and go to medical school here, but then we had an idea, well, why don't we start a business together? And so we thought that was fun. We didn't have any money or any business plan or anything that you need to start a business, but we thought, well, let's do that anyway. So we started an interior design firm. And then from that grew La Lune Collection. We started doing manufacturing furniture as well. So we've been doing this for now 41 years.
1977 would not have been a good time to be in the Argentinian military.
That's right. That's right.
It was actually not a good time to even be starting a business. You know, the economy was really terrible in the United States back then. Remember, we had loans with huge interest rates. So it was an endeavor that was prompted by being young and not knowing what we didn't know.
Yes, I remember that was when mortgages were like 15%,
right.
Yeah. Something like that. I mean, it was horrible.
Right. Our line of credit, I remember, was 22%. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we survived not having any experience or any of our own money or anything else. But actually, we were successful. And we did interior design work for about 10, 15 years. And then eventually, we decided we liked the Laloon, the manufacturing furniture part of the business, so we retired from doing interior design work and have been doing furniture, rustic furniture nationally for 40 years now.
Mm-hmm. What made you think, as a French major and a pre-med student, that interior design was something you knew anything about?
Well, again, it's youth. You know, when you're 22 years old, you can do anything. And I was actually working at First Wisconsin Bank when we started the business. I had a French degree, and I was working in the international division. And we were downtown, and Mario did have a background in design and in furniture design specifically, just because of his family business.
Yes. When I was 16 years old, we immigrated from Argentina, and my mother and father and I decided we'd start a business together. So I was a third owner. I did all the talking, all the sales. My father did all the upholstery work. She was an upholsterer. And my mother did the bookkeeping and business part of the business. So I had some knowledge of furniture and business from that history. But that's a little different than doing interior design work or having a furniture factory. But it was somewhat related. Again, what Kathy said, we were 22 and we thought, well, we could start a business, go to medical school, maybe try out for the Olympics next. I don't... we thought we could do it all.
You know, and I think it was also the times, the 1970s. I mean, you know, there weren't as many restrictions on, you know, things that might impede starting a business. So it was the times too. I think it's more difficult for young people to start businesses today than it might have been for us in the 1970s. Do you agree, Mario?
I agree. And also some of the experts say that our generation was less risk-averse, and that for that reason, there were more startups mm-hmm. back then than there are now. And I think we were just, it was really not our plan to start a rustic furniture company. We had a showroom starting in 1978 on Wisconsin Avenue next to the Pfister Hotel. And we had someone who stayed at the Pfister who came into our showroom and said, "Hey, I love your showroom. Do you guys do restaurants?" And we said, "Sure, we had never done a restaurant, but we thought...
You were 23 at this point,
yes,
you could still do everything.
We could do everything. So we said, yes, of course we can do a restaurant." So he said, "Great, because I'm opening up some restaurants in Chicago, and they're in a rustic theme, and a southern rustic theme, and would you like to take a stab at that?" And so I said, "Sure." So I went to the Goldemeyer Library, looked in the card catalog for rustic everything, rustic furniture, rustic design, rustic hats, whatever I could find that was rustic. And so I ran across books that had drawings of rustic furniture that had been made hundreds of years ago. And I thought this was just really so fascinating that there were times in history when different cultures made rustic furniture just out of branches with the bark still on. And sometimes those were gypsies who came to the U.S. and would sell their furniture alongside the roads. African-American slaves would sometimes make rustic furniture. The Scottish immigrants, there were just many groups of people that made this rustic furniture. And at that time, it was not a popular thing. And I thought, gee, that would be really cool for the restaurant. So I designed a few items out of willow and found some people who could make my designs. And it was a big hit. The restaurants were a big hit. We would get calls from people at the restaurant who had visited the restaurant, and they would ask, where could we buy that kind of furniture? So we thought, maybe there's a market, maybe there's a customer for a line of rustic furniture. So to hedge our bet, we weren't sure about it. So we just did a little brochure. It was about maybe 20 pages. And we sent it out around the country to reps and showrooms, and it took off right away. So anyway, so we sent the brochure around the country, and one of our very first customers was Ralph Lauren. He saw our brochure and our samples that we had sent out to a showroom in New York, and he liked it and wanted us to do furniture for his new home in Montauk in New York State. And you can imagine, we were 23. We were just starting out, and to have Ralph Lauren order our furniture for his home was really encouraging. We thought maybe we got something here that, you know, Ralph is interested in. So that convinced us that this could be a good thing. And so then we gradually grew the line from maybe 20 pieces to 600 pieces like we have now. And yet about half of our production is custom. So even though we have so many items in the line, we still do quite a bit of custom furniture. And primarily we sell to through the interior design industry, but also directly to customers as well.
You know, I'm imagining 600 pieces in a line. Do you keep them in stock or do you make them as orders come in?
We don't have anything in stock because we have so many items in the line, because we do so much custom work, because each item is available in 20 some finishes and different fabrics. It doesn't make any sense for us to have any stock whatsoever. So we get an order, and usually we're about 6 to 8 week delivery. Sometimes in the spring when we get really busy, the spring and summer, we'll go to 8 to 10 week delivery. But most of the time we can deliver within that period of time. And then as soon as we get an order, it hits a shop floor. We have a pretty good system of getting it through our factory in that period of time. And it's very efficient. I think it's much more eco-friendly to do things, to make things after they're sold, than to bring 1,000 chairs from China, warehouse them, keep them there for years, pay for all the expenses of warehousing it and, you know, taking inventory and all those kind of things, rather than the way we do it.
And on the eco-friendly topic, also all of our woods are from Wisconsin. Everything is Wisconsin-based. We use two main types of wood, poplar and willow, but everything's Wisconsin.
That's really wonderful. Do you actually buy from different people who harvest, or do you go out and how does that work?
Yes. When we first started our company, we used to send out our own crews to cut the wood. And then we ran into, out in the field, we ran into loggers who asked us what we were doing, why we were doing that. And so we eventually started to employ them. And so now they are cut for us and sell us the logs. So they're not actually our employees. They just, you know, work for themselves as loggers. And then, today we had for example, a large a truck come at 5 o'clock this morning with a big load. And we use the woods we use are both invasive. Poplar, which is about 90% of the woods we use, is invasive because it grows back so quickly in the northern part of Wisconsin. About 20 years ago, we had a call from a young lady at the DNR, and she asked if it was possible for us to make furniture out of poplar. And we asked her why, and she said, well, what happens when they clear cut for the logging industry, they take pines and oaks and elms and different trees, but only the poplar comes back. It comes back very quickly. And so it doesn't allow the other trees to take hold because it's so dense and so it grows back so fast. So we thin out the woods of the poplar. People are very happy in those parts of the state to get rid of it. And it's a great wood for us. It's fast growing. It grows relatively straight and it's strong, not too heavy. It's perfect for what we do. But it took us about 2 years of experimenting to figure out when to cut it, how to bend it, how to finish it, and several other things.
Is it considered a soft wood like a pine, or is it a hard wood?
It's a medium density.
Medium wood, okay.
Yeah, it's a medium density wood. And to make a dining chair, ideally you want a wood that's strong, but you also don't want it to be too heavy. So if you make a dining chair out of maple, for example, it's strong, but it's really heavy. So it can weigh 60 pounds and it's hard to move it around. So what you want ideally is a wood like poplar, which is very strong, but not too heavy.
And it's actually very beautiful wood, you know, on a tabletop. It's a very beautiful wood.
Are we looking?
No, this is not poplar. What is this, Mark?
This is pine.
Pine. This is pine, yeah.
Are we sitting in poplar?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
This is peeled poplar. As you will notice, we each have very different skill sets. And I think that's part of the reason why we've lasted so long is we are a good partnership. And I think that's one of the keys to success in business is finding somebody who is a good partner. And we've certainly found that.
So what about succession? What's going to happen when you eventually retire? Because the dual head of the company is going to eventually stop?
That's a question we've been wrestling with right now. We have three children. We don't think any of them want to take over the company. About 15, 20 years ago, we had some offers to either sell a company or have partners, boards of directors, and all those kind of things. And we said no then because we were younger and it was fun. Now that we're in our mid-60s, we're thinking, okay, we'd love to do this for the next for another 40 years, but we know that that's not going to happen. So, you know, we're starting to think about what do we do? Do we sell the company? Do we just retire and go away? I'm not sure. And so if there's anybody out there who wants to buy a furniture factory, let's talk.
How many people do you have working for you here?
About 30.
Okay, so it's a significant payroll.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got your contractors doing other things up
right.
in the woods
right.
or wherever.
Right.
So yeah, and right. you know, and one of the other things, and you mentioned it sort of in passing a little bit ago, is that you've done a lot of other things within the community. I mean, we're sitting right next to the Florentine Opera that you. I don't know if you rent it, gave them the space, however you work that out, this is their home now. And it's because of an arrangement with La Lune.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was telling Kathy that we're involved in a lot of nonprofits, and nonprofits tend to have a mission. You know, their goal is to fill their mission, whatever that may be. And for most businesses, the goal is to be profitable and make money. We're kind of a hybrid of these two things. We're involved in lots of nonprofit organizations. We've co-founded, you know, youth centers and art centers and other things in the city. And the Florentine Opera Center is another one. We're fortunate that we had this luxury of being able to use our time and our talents and to help other organizations. And it's the same skills that I think made our company, us to be able to start our company, and that entrepreneurship that we had to start our company also was the reason that we've been able to help other organizations in the same way.
So as you're looking back on taking those risks and leaping into the unknown with this business and then, you know, working on the nonprofits and kind of, you know, creating this net of both business and social awareness, what would you say to somebody who's 22 and looking to do something similar? What kind of advice would you offer them?
My short answer would be just be brave. Be brave, take the step. I know it's scary, but be brave and go for it.
You know, we've noticed over the last couple of years that there is a really strong awareness amongst millennial and younger generation about social justice and how that relates to business. So sometimes we have people apply for work here who will say, I want to work for you because I hear about all the things that you do in the city that you and your wife do, and I want to be part of it and so on. And I think that's really great. In Argentina, there's a saying that we all bring our little grain of sand. I think it's because we have so many ants, and they each bring a little grain of sand, and then they build this huge 10-foot-high home anthill. But anyway, you know, we all do our little bit. None of us can by ourselves fix the world. But you just do what you can in your neighborhood, in your city. And I think that if we all did that, we can fix the world.
Well, I want to thank you both for sitting and talking with me in this lovely room. I've been looking at the doors behind me, which are beautiful. Are those willow or those bamboo? Or what are they?
Actually, that is poplar.
That's
okay. Poplar, very thin, you know, 1-inch diameter poplar. And as I mentioned, we do a lot of custom work. So we do doors and railings and ceilings and all kinds of things for both residential and commercial installations.
And so it's been a lovely thing to be looking at while we've been talking about this. I want to thank you both so much.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's an honor to be on your show.
It is.
Mario and Kathy Costantini are the co-founders of La Lune, a furniture company located in River West. There is more information about it at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then visit with Milwaukee's Prometheus Trio to hear music of Beethoven, Brahms, and Moravec. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. The piano trio is one of classical chamber music's most common groupings of musicians. As the name indicates, the piano is the constant. The other two instruments can include the French horn and the clarinet, but the two most common are the violin and the cello. From Haydn and Mozart to contemporary composers, the repertoire for the piano trio is large and diverse. Milwaukee's Prometheus Trio performed three pieces last week that span the timeline, from early Beethoven to Brahms to the contemporary composer Paul Moravec. Lake Effect was preempted the day we were going to air our conversation, so even though we missed the concert, the music and the conversation is still worth hearing. The trio is pianist Stephanie Jacob, violinist Margot Schwartz, and cellist Scott Tisdell. Here they are with part of the first movement of Beethoven's Opus 1 in C minor. Margot, Stephanie, and Scott, it is such a pleasure to finally sit down with you as the Prometheus Trio and hear some music and have a little conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming down to the conservatory. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. And we just heard some Beethoven. And I was saying to someone before I came down here, I didn't know what you was on the concert. I purposely didn't look. And I said, oh, I hope there's some Beethoven and I hope there's some Brahms. And there is both of those things. Tell me a little bit about this Beethoven piece, because it's very early in his career, right?
It is early. It says in my music, 1793 to 94 was when it was composed. So he was 23, 24, and a young lion, big piano part that he wrote for himself. He was still studying with Haydn, at least nominally. That was something he did when he left Bonn and moved to Vienna. And
I can hear it in the way it's composed. It sounds, there's a little bit of Haydn there.
Yes, yeah. But Haydn actually, this is the third of a set of three, and apparently it was the one that Beethoven liked best. It's the only one in a minor key. And Haydn thought it was just way too shocking for then contemporary audiences. So you almost have to listen to it with old ears, really old ears, and be shocked by it.
And this is before Beethoven really kind of launched into what would become the romantic stuff that he became, right? I mean, yeah, he was still very much in the classical.
Yeah, but it's there. It's there.
It still sounds like Beethoven.
Oh, totally.
It really, I mean, you could say there are certain Haydn-esque elements to it, but sort of the shocking part, I think, is something that we have tried to
work on really hard.
Emphasize. Sorry. And it's Opus 1, but he wrote a lot of music before then. He wanted his Opus 1 to be something important, and that's why he was very annoyed with Haydn for not liking what he thought was his best one, and even thought Haydn might be a little jealous of his work.
From Beethoven to the other big B, one of the other big Bs, which is Brahms. And this piece is one of my favorites in the entire repertoire. Mm-hmm. There's just that opening, however many measures, it just,
you know, I feel like my whole body just kind of aligns somewhere, yeah. You know, that I didn't even know that I was out of alignment until I heard those chords and that music. And that must be so much fun to play.
It's so satisfying. It's this I've only been playing since I was in college, but it's every Brahms trio that I'm playing, there are the three big ones, the three for this arrangement, and then there's the horn trio and the clarinet trio. Whichever piece I'm playing by Brahms is my favorite at the time. So right now this is my favorite, but it isn't really to diss the other ones.
And one of the things I love the way he, and we'll hear it in just a minute, yeah. But you know, you start and then the cello comes in with that deep, rich, and then the violin yeah. comes in and adds, and the layering
yes.
of this is so delicious.
Yeah, it's so gorgeous that, I don't know, me personally, I have to kind of say, okay, we have, 30 or 50 bars before he ever actually writes a forte, and it's very easy to kind of get overcooked too soon, and that kind of in a way spoils it. So I try to start it asking rather soft, even though it's extremely rich sounding.
Do you find the same, Margot, that it's just, you yeah. almost get lost in it? It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it has a real warmth mm-hmm. about it. Obviously not surprising for Brahms, like you said, but the key, I think, is again kind of surprising, because you think of a key with five sharps, you would think it would be sort of uncomfortable or sort of like you ate something too sour or something, but then it's so warm, and I wonder what made him pick that key. There's other pieces of his that are also warm, but they're in sort of more reasonable keys, so this seems kind of like an aberration, and I just wonder what kind of possessed him.
Well, you kind of feel like maybe he meant B flat. Which would be even warmer.
Yeah.
Right.
But then it would be overcooked.
Yeah. Right. There's something very bright about it, while also having that warmth, which is an interesting combination.
You mentioned before you started it that it was written in 1854, but he reworked it in the 1890s. What did he change?
Oh, most especially the length. Like the original version of the first movement that we played a bit of is over 400 measures, and this is, I think it's in the low 300s, I think.
So he cut?
Oh, he cut a lot. He cut a lot.
He improved it immensely in the revision.
The version we're playing, it sounds wonderfully leisurely. You don't know, unless you do know, that it's streamlined, but it is considerably streamlined from the original.
All right. Well, let's hear the piece, the part of it that you're going to play, and go ahead and reintroduce it, if you would.
This is the first movement of Brahms' wonderful B major trio, written originally in 1854 and revised in 1891.
Thank you.
a little bit of Brahms to put in the middle of our interview. Before we get to the last piece, I want to talk a little bit about chamber music in general, because it is one of my favorite, no matter the type of music, whether it's classical or jazz or rock and roll, whatever. I like a small ensemble because I want to hear all the parts. I like hearing the interplay. I mean, I love symphonies too, but there's something about this. And so I know, Scott, you're with the Milwaukee Symphony. Margot, do you play at the Symphony also?
Yeah.
So what does this do for you that playing for the Symphony does not?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is that we are our own bosses. We get to decide, you know, how we want to play at the tempo, you know, the inflection, the phrasing. And that's really empowering to be in control of what you're doing, whereas we follow the conductor in an orchestra, and that, you know, depending on the conductor, that can be wonderful too, but it's really nice to be in charge. But the other thing is, you know, we're string players. We have many people playing the same part as us, and we have a lot more responsibility when we just have one on a part.
Well, for me, it's about the repertoire. It's just so incredible. I mean, yes, piano trio, but also string quartet. There's so much music out there that is, you know, you just wouldn't want to miss the chance to play it. And orchestra music is also really satisfying to play, most of it. I would say that for me, it's about the chance to just also deepen your understanding of each composer. The symphonic repertoire has certain qualities that are just not possible with chamber music, and vice versa. So it's a really nice way to understand the language of a composer or of a style of music or something like that.
So. You could make the case. I know that Brahms and Beethoven both wrote fantastic orchestra music, but you could make the case that in both cases, their greatest music is their chamber music. I mean, I think that's a pretty strong case. And I mean, you talk about the Beethoven string quartets or any of Brahms' chamber music that he didn't destroy is an absolute masterpiece.
How long has Prometheus been in some iteration now? Okay. It's been long before I got here.
This is our 20th season. And this is, what season is it of yours?
I think five.
Yeah. So this is the first time we've played it with Margot. So each time that we've played it with somebody else. And they've all been wonderful, just as each Brahms piece that I'm playing is my favorite. You know, each violinist is my favorite at the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, each time I get to play this piece, it's the best. It's just the Brahms in particular. But I would just say, for me playing chamber music, because I don't play an orchestra except extra very occasionally, for me, it's the comparison of playing solo piano and playing chamber music or playing a gig. Playing a gig is fine, and it's fun always. And I do a lot of collaborating with, especially with student violinists and cellists, and it's really fun for me. But ever since I discovered chamber music, which was at music camp when I was 12 years old, like, that's been my thing. And I got to play my first Beethoven piano trio when I was 13, and I was like, oh, this is what I should be doing. This is my thing.
It's like you feel at home.
Yeah, this is totally at home. And we've been so grateful all these years to the conservatory for, you know, giving us a home. And they were the ones who first sponsored us when we started. Like, this is, as a resident ensemble. And that's just been a wonderful partnership.
And so, looking forward, there's no end in sight.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. Lots more repertoire.
Yes. And because we don't want to repeat anything too often, but at the same time, why wouldn't we play the greatest pieces? But then there are the less explored parts of the repertoire or newer pieces. We do quite a few relatively recently composed pieces.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things that I know is a hallmark for you is to bring in at least one, what most of us would consider new.
Yeah.
Even if it's been in the last 10 or 20 years, it's not part of the 19th century and early 20th century repertoire. It's, you know, it's later. And so when you come into something like what we're going to hear, which was written, what, about 12 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, about that.
So very recent.
And he's still alive.
And he's still, so living composer. Mm-hmm. And when you start thinking about that repertoire, do you approach it any differently, or is it exactly the same way you'd approach the Brahms or approach the Beethoven?
Well, the biggest difference is we're starting from scratch. We're kind of fans of Paul Moravec. Stephanie and I, we've played, this is our third piece of his?
Third and fourth, yeah.
Third and fourth pieces. So we kind of know what to expect with his music, but it's always fun to kind of build a piece up from the ground.
Yeah, because you're not building on 150 years of tradition of other people playing it.
And what's more, we're not building on our own tradition as we are with the Brahms of, oh yeah, this is what we do. And of course, we're doing it with Margot, so we're going to discuss what it is we do and we're going to change things. But there's this comfort level that with a new piece, then that's a different kind of comfort level because we're exploring it together.
And the little bit I heard, and we're going to hear some in just a moment, he's actually very melodic.
Oh, very melodic, yeah. Very tonal, gorgeous harmonies, and I think that's what draws us most to him.
Well, I want to thank you, all three of you, for playing for us, for talking with me. After 14 years, it's about time I got here. We've been trying to do this for the last 10 years,
right,
I think, and
right.
So we finally got it done. I'm looking forward to hearing the Moravec, but before I do, I just want to say thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for everything.
The Prometheus Trio performing the music of Paul Moravec. Jason Reavy recorded the music and the conversation at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. The trio will have another concert later this spring. There is information at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.